The Narcolepsy Nerd Alert series invites listeners to dive deeper into specific topics relevant to living with narcolepsy. For more on this topic, please check out our corresponding toolkit, available for free on our website to download, print, and share. The link to the toolkit and other Narcolepsy Nerd Alert topics is in the show notes, or you can go to project-sleep.com. Welcome to Project Sleep's podcast. Project Sleep is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and advocating for sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. I'm your host, Julie Flygar. We're so glad you're here as we work together towards making sleep cool. On this podcast, all guests express their own opinions. While medical diagnoses and treatment options are discussed for educational purposes, this information should not be taken as medical advice. Each person's experience is so unique, which is why it's so important to always consult your own medical team when making decisions about your own health. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a Project Sleep podcast episode. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a rating or review wherever you listen so that we can reach more listeners and raise more awareness. Welcome. We are so excited to be with an amazing group today for our Narcolepsy Nerd Alert on relationships and narcolepsy, all things from swiping and dating to long-term relationships and marriage. So we're really, really excited. I'm Julie Flygar. And just to add a little bit extra to my intro, before I ask everybody else to share a little bit more, I was in a relationship when I was diagnosed with narcolepsy at age 24. I was in law school and I've been dating that boyfriend for, I don't even remember, about like 8 months or so, I think, before I was diagnosed. And then if you read my book, you probably know what happened with that relationship, that ended. And today, 16 years later, I am single. So that's my introduction and a little bit about my background. And so I just have everyone go around and just share a little bit about your background really quickly. And how about let's kick things off with Taylor. Do you want to go ahead and go first? And then we'll go to Jeff and then Lindsay and then Bob and Margaret.
Hi, I'm Taylor. I am 27. I live in Los Angeles. And I was diagnosed with narcolepsy right after my freshman year of college. I got that diagnosis in large part thanks to the guy that I was dating at the time, or at least my doctor had suggested that I might have narcolepsy, but I didn't take that seriously until he said that he knew someone with narcolepsy and that he thought I could have it. And then I went and got a sleep study. So really grateful for the way that that all worked out to get the diagnosis so early in life. I'm not with him anymore. That relationship did end. And I'm with someone else now who is really wonderful. We've been together for a little over a year. And I'll also add that I've been helping Project Sleep with the Nerd Alert series since the beginning. And I'm very excited, very happy to join you all today for the broadcast and to talk about narcolepsy and relationships.
Hi, my name is Jeff. I'm also in the Southern California area. I was diagnosed with narcolepsy in my late 30s. I was married at the time, and it came about through sleep studies to correct snoring, because that became an issue in my marriage quickly. That's how they identified the narcolepsy. I've had some challenges with it, in relationships. None of them have really been insurmountable, of course. Some relationships had other challenges, but yeah, I like doing these things because I learned from them and I learned from how other people handle these situations. So I'm looking forward to this.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Scola. I am in Los Angeles. I am engaged, and to the guy that I had been dating for a month when I got diagnosed. So he's been there for my whole narcolepsy journey, and ups and downs and a couple of laughs in between, and very happy to be here with y'all now.
Margaret and I, for my part, I'm from Ohio, but we've been in northwestern Vermont 12 years now to be with our children. I was a lawyer for many years and then retired and came up here. I was diagnosed around 1975, 76, in there, by an intern, and that's part of our story too. So I'll save that. Tell us about you.
Bob and I were married probably 5, 6, 7 years before he got narcolepsy. So we went through all the stages of quandaries about, you know, symptoms and what does this mean and what is this bizarre thing that we seem to be dealing with. But as he was saying, luckily, I worked in hospital work. I was in hospital management for a number of years. So I had a resource in terms of doctors and interns who were fresh from medical school books. And so he was quick to diagnose it for us, which was a good thing. But we've been married like 52 years, a couple of kids and 4 grandchildren. So we've been dealing with narcolepsy for a while in many stages of our lives. But it's been something that I think our family has come to accept and know that that's part of who we are. And we live with it and laugh about it sometimes and cry about it others. But I think ultimately it's a good thing that we have a relationship which has survived.
Thank you guys all for introducing yourself. We're so excited to have this great guest panel. And just a quick reminder that we have this really wonderful friends and family narcolepsy toolkit. And so in here, we talk about more general relationships with people, loved ones and friends and family. But of course, there's so much in here that is also helpful for romantic or relationships. So in here, we really broke things down. We talked about supportive communications, how to communicate in more effective ways to make sure that the person with narcolepsy and the supporter understand each other best they can, and then supportive actions as well, like things that people can do. So it's a really wonderful resource as well as today's discussion. And I just wanted to kind of also remind everyone as we go into this topic that when we talk about living with a chronic condition like narcolepsy, we like to think of this breakdown where there's a medical experience, you know, managing symptoms, accessing healthcare and treatments. But there's also the social experience, you know, managing your relationships, your roles and cultural expectations, disclosure, communications. And there's also your own internal experience, you know, how you feel internally about your experience and your own acceptance of the condition. And so I just think that's a great reminder because relationships and dating is really involved probably in all of these areas, right? And so I just think it's a great thing to think about and remembering all the different aspects of living with narcolepsy. And so we're going to start with some of the early dating questions because, you know, I often hear from a lot of our scholarship recipients that are young. How do you make dating possible or you know, is it possible with narcolepsy? And especially a lot of questions around when do you tell someone that you have narcolepsy? So this might be for those of us that were already diagnosed and then entering the dating world. So does anyone have anything to share about how, you know, they decided when to disclose that they had narcolepsy to someone in a dating context?
Well, my current girlfriend and I kind of came up in basic conversation. Probably a lot of times these things have to be said when somebody's talking to you and you fall asleep in mid-sentence. And they kind of take it as they're being boring. So it's kind of a necessity to kind of explain it. You're not boring. That's why I'm falling asleep right now. Then you have to kind of explain it a little bit. That's the content. It's happened to me also, like in job situations where somebody's explaining something to me and it fall off in mid-sentence. They're like, how can you even do that? So it's, you want to make sure that somebody doesn't get offended by you falling asleep while they're talking. So that's how this one came up about in this relationship.
And how did that person respond?
They were surprised because it's not, until I met Taylor, I had never met anybody else that had it. And so it was kind of, it's all, so from that point, it's been enlightening, the whole process, this whole network of people and this, how many people actually have it. And I've learned more from watching these things about it than I've knew from the past. So, but it's like, what's that? Does that mean you can't sleep? No, that's the opposite. Nobody really knows what it is. So it's always an educational type discussion. But
she knew what it was when you mentioned it, right?
She did, yeah, which was surprising.
And did you guys explain that? I was getting my Xyrem shipment. So did you guys explain the connection that, Taylor, you're the daughter of Jeff's girlfriend?
Yeah. We did a little bit.
Okay.
And I remember, I'm sure she's happy with me telling you this. I remember her coming home from that date and a couple days later telling me that she met someone who had narcolepsy and that she immediately was able to ask him, oh, so did you try this medication and this one? And just, she's like, yeah, I mean, didn't tell him right away that her daughter, me, has narcolepsy, but just was already familiar with it a little bit. And it's been awesome to get to have these kind of conversations about life with narcolepsy, basically whenever I see Jeff. I mean, just really, really wonderful.
It was interesting to meet somebody, and it was strange. We felt like that maybe it was kind of a blessing or a sign that this connection that we had was from a higher power, bringing us together for a higher purpose, letting us know that there was a connection to find somebody that had a daughter in narcolepsy. And had never met anybody in 30 years or 25 years of having it.
That is so cool. Taylor, have you had experiences of telling people in early dating situations?
Yeah. With my current boyfriend, I think it was a little bit different because when we met, I was already working with Project Sleep on the Nerd Alert Toolkits, which I'm very passionate about, and I'm very proud of the work that we do. So I think I kind of bragged about my job first, saying that I wrote about narcolepsy and sleep disorders. And then he logically followed that with, oh, do you also have one of those conditions? And I told him about narcolepsy. He didn't exactly know what it meant, but he went and looked it up and did his own research, which really means a lot to me. Like, I can explain it, sure, but it's wonderful when someone takes it upon themselves to go and learn a little bit.
Yeah. I'll just share a little bit about my early dating. When I was soon after I was diagnosed, I'd met someone and, you know, kind of had a crush on him. Wasn't really sure where it was going, right? But he was new to my life, really, and I had a crush on him. And narcolepsy was new to me. So I think I'd been diagnosed just under a year. And so at that point, I decided, like, for a few dates not to say anything about it. But it was really hard because narcolepsy does impact so many aspects of my life that there would be natural questions, like even about dinner or something, where my answer would probably have to do with narcolepsy because the timing of when I eat has to do with my medication, right? But I decided I was going to keep it, like, to myself. And then finally, I think it was after about four times we were hanging out, I finally, like, burst out in tears and was like, I have to tell you something. I have narcolepsy. And it was like really interesting for me because it was so emotional for me. And he was like, oh, okay. Like, well, why didn't you just, you know, that's like fine. Like, why didn't you? So I kind of built it up as such a big deal and like the disclosure of it to him. And he was just kind of like, oh, okay. Like, cool. Like, no problem. And I think after that, I thought to just bring it up sooner with people, basically, and let it flow more naturally into the conversation. I will just say, for those in online dating, you know, I have done some of the apps and stuff like that. And there was for a while, I did put it in my online dating profile. I think I put a t-shirt of myself that said narcolepsy, not alone, you know, a picture. I don't know that I ever, like, wrote that I have narcolepsy specifically, but, you know, I thought that was kind of a good way. And even in some of those online app conversations, I would let it naturally flow if it was something that made sense to say. And then I did have one experience, though, where someone had written in their profile, a guy had said that he's so interesting that he could even, like, keep people with narcolepsy awake or something. It was some weird joke. I guess it's from a Most Interesting Man Alive advertisement. I did end up finding the advertisement later, but I didn't like him, but I decided to match with him anyway. And then I wrote, I really wonder if you could keep me awake because I'm really a person with narcolepsy. And then he thought I was, like, joking. And then I was like, no, I'm not joking. Like, I really have narcolepsy. I don't know if you know. So I did. It was kind of a weird, maybe educational moment, even though I wasn't actually interested in him. But anyway, so I don't know if anyone else has any swiping experience. I don't think
you know, there was no swiping right or left back when Bob and Margaret, when you guys were dealing with all this, I guess, at the beginning.
No, we never dealt with it before we were married because we didn't know that.
Lucky you. Lucky you. You're not missing out. Okay. Well, any early dating experiences? Come on, guys. People have to have some bad. We got to have some more bad. Anyone have any bad stories they want to share about people not being so responsive? Because I do kind of think that narcolepsy is an interesting way to sort of, I don't know, weed people out that maybe aren't. There's certain topics, like I think like grief or chronic illness, that not everyone can take such an interest in or ability to understand that adversity can be a strength or, you know, something like, I don't know. I don't want to like try to put a bow on it, but I've personally found that it was one way, not, you know, that it was a complete deal breaker if someone wasn't understanding at first, but that it could be a one red flag if I saw other red flags about someone, if they responded kind of poorly or didn't take much of an interest. Anyone else have any bad experiences like that?
I mean, I have loads of bad experiences online dating, but I didn't get diagnosed until I was with my person. Yeah, the online dating world is crazy about that stuff. You know, some people collect like sneakers or like Hummel figurines. I collect autoimmune disorders. So I also have celiac disease. And dating with celiac disease, there were people that would like weed me out immediately because we wouldn't be able to like go to their foodie restaurants or something like that. But I did, that was the beginning of the end for my college boyfriend, that I would always fall asleep when we were hanging out at night. I don't know, maybe he was boring, but it was probably the narcolepsy talking there. So.
All right. Well, I guess if no one else has anything else and any other bad stories they want to share about early dating, Taylor.
Yeah, I can give a quick one from before I met the guy that I'm with now. I didn't do the online dating like you guys did. I actually met someone at a bar while I was out with my aunties, and he was a good dancer, so they really encouraged me to go on a date with him. First strange thing about this date, he invited me over to make dinner. So I thought, oh, he's a great chef. He made one steak, put it on one plate, and like gave me bites of it, which was a little infantilizing. But then when we got into a conversation, narcolepsy came up naturally, like you said, Julie. And his only knowledge around chronic illness was from a podcast. So he made some really interesting suggestions for what I could do to like cure myself on this very first date. Didn't sit well with me at the time. I didn't like take it personally. I realized he was just trying to keep conversation going, and it was the only thing that he had heard about chronic illness probably. But yeah, he suggested that I like cut out all food groups except for red meat, and maybe my sleepiness would go away. I just was not enjoying that connection, so I didn't see him again.
Oh my God, the red meat guy.
All about steak, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, the one interesting date I had was in Washington, D.C., and he took me to a really fancy Italian restaurant. I think he was a realtor, so he was really into like fancy, being fancy. And I brought up I had narcolepsy. And by this point, I was like you, Taylor, I bring it up in a pretty place of pride because I was already like writing a book and I'd been featured in some magazine articles. So I felt like I brought it up to him as a, you know, not in that crying, like, oh my God, I have narcolepsy. I brought in like, I have narcolepsy. I'm so proud of what I've accomplished. And he literally said to me, is there anything else I should know that's wrong with you? And I think it was before the breadbasket, or we were at the breadbasket phase. I was like, oh no, do I have to keep going on this date? But I will say, like you, Taylor, it wasn't the only thing wrong. Because of course, if someone says something like that, maybe they're just nervous and you could maybe educate them over time. However, I also said I was writing a book, and he said he couldn't remember the last time he'd read a book like ever in his life. And then I was like, okay, maybe we're just really not meant to be. So that was the two strikes I remember about my realtor friend back in DC. So whatever, you know, I think it can be something that can weed someone out in a way if they're not really all that understanding. So when you're in the early stages of a relationship, and, you know, I think there's a lot around managing time, expectations, planning, commitments that you make plans and then maybe things fall through. So, or, you know, symptoms happen. So how do you guys How have you managed communicating around symptoms? Are there any like good analogies that you found that work, or like coping things with some of that?
Well, I mean, I handle the symptoms differently. I, of course, take naps throughout the day. Most of the time it's one in early afternoon, but sometimes it could be two, or, you know, and then there's the ones that come, you know, to fall into on accident, you know, watching a movie after the third nap. But that's the only challenge I've had with it. It's, you know, we can't watch any romantic comedies because I fall asleep right away. So it always has to be action packed, or I have to sit at the edge of the seat. And what we remedied that is I would massage my girlfriend's feet during the movie, one foot for the first 45 minutes and another foot for the other 45 minutes. And that worked, and that had a double benefit. But, and she liked that, of course.
Yeah, that's a great solution.
Yeah. And so
maybe we shouldn't tell this to other people, though.
Right. Yeah. And so it's, but I still have to sit at the edge of the seat. And the challenging part was that we'd finish the feet like 5 minutes before the end of the movie, and then I'd sit back and I'd fall asleep in a second. And then she doesn't like to tell me what happened at the end.
Hey, we know what happens at the end of the rom-com. They get together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, see? She never says, no, I'm not going to explain the whole thing to you. But it's always in the last 5 to 7 minutes. I think I can stay awake. And I sit back and seconds later, it's over. I missed it. That's probably the biggest challenge I've had, which is not really a challenge. It's given us a chance to get closer by rubbing our feet. So
I also have an experience with TV and movies, because movie watching is very important to my boyfriend. And there are some shows that he loves that were very important to him. But I don't like to watch anything with like graphic scenes, any violence, because it can make my nightmares a lot worse. But I was interested in the story of his favorite show. So our compromise on that was that he's seen it a few times. He knows when those scenes are coming up. So he would warn me or just cover my eyes so that I could watch the parts of the show that we would enjoy together, but not maybe have, you know, more fuel for my nightmares. So I thought that was a good little compromise.
I love that. Humor has really been our sort of solution for all of this. There's so much that feels out of your control with narcolepsy. And on days where your symptoms are worse and you're already feeling bad for canceling plans or being behind on things, laughing just makes everything a little bit better. For us, most of the time, it's me looking at him and saying, why am I so tired? And him responding, you have narcolepsy. And, you know, one of the major things for me, I have not done well with medication. So I bounce around on medications a lot. And 5.5 years into my diagnosis, I'm on my 16th combination of medication. And one of the like telltale signs for me that medication is not going well is that I really lose control of my emotions. And I used to have this pegboard with letters on it that you change yourself. And I had a Gandhi quote on it. And one day, my fiance took all of the letters off and wrote days since meltdown and put a zero, and told me that I could have a prize when I got to 10 days, which I thought he said fries. So we had a date to Five Guys to get me fries when I made it to 10 days without a meltdown. And, you know, it just, you have to laugh about it because it affects both of you. I mean, it's always in your relationship. And when things are going to come up, and when a last minute nap is going to be needed, or we need to change plans for the evening. So that's definitely been something that has made it, if not less challenging, more fun.
Bob and Margaret, how about you guys with adjusting plans and, you know, flexibility? How have you guys managed that?
Yeah, not so much as part of early dating, because symptoms didn't appear till 5 or 6 years into our marriage, but it was the sudden onset of all the symptoms of narcolepsy 1 with cataplexy over the course of maybe 2 years' time. Where, you know, during that time, I, with increasing frequency, fall asleep at the dinner table with kids in the middle of a sentence. You know, like Jeff said, how does one do that? Or frequent falls down steps and usually hurting myself, and Margaret, and she's wondering what's going on here. Or being aggressive in bed with hallucinations. Hypnagogic hallucinations, always in the form of somebody invading our house, somebody that I'm going to have to lock up with physically, which might mean punching out, but the only one there is Margaret. So she would wonder what's going on. The sleep paralysis thing in the mornings. And then we went to see one of the internists, like Margaret mentioned, in his first year of family practice. And Margaret happened to come with me. I mean, we planned that she didn't just show up. And we happened to talk about these symptoms, which were seemingly unrelated. I didn't know there was any connection. And he asked a few important questions and told us I had narcolepsy. I guess he remembered his couple hours that he studied sleep disorder. And that was a big help, the experience of Margaret seeing these symptoms all appear, and she working and me working. I think it was a rough period to go through.
Yeah. You know, you talk about flexibility, though. I think we learn to cope with needing to go to bed at a certain time and get up at a certain time and struggle with when you were eating or not eating. And our son was mentioning to me the other day, we were talking about flexibility with meal times. And he said, yeah, Mom, he said, I remember you'd have dinner ready and on the table and the phone would ring and it would be Dad saying, oh, I missed my bus stop. I'm at the end of the line. Could you come pick me up? So I would have to drop everything, get in the car, go pick him up, bring him home so we could have dinner together. So, you know, but we laugh about it now, but at the time it was frustrating.
When you were going through those early symptom experiences too, was it always clear to you guys that this was something kind of like external outside of, you know, I mean, or were there ever kind of questions for you, Margaret, of kind of like, you know, is he finding things boring, or, you know, like, did you ever think of it as part of like a character change or like a, you know, something like that? Or was it pretty clear, like, oh, something medical is happening, we just don't know what it is?
No, I don't think that was true. And I don't think I thought it was something medical happening. I think there were times when I felt like he's bored with me. He doesn't find me attractive anymore. There were, I think, other times when I was thinking, gosh, this isn't the man I married. He's changed a lot. You know, I mean, if we would go out someplace for dinner, he would be sleepy at the dinner table. And I would try to think of things to talk about that were more exciting or more interesting. But it oftentimes, you know, didn't work. You can't help but feel frustrated and feel like you're not being appreciated for who you are. It's inevitable, I think.
Margaret mentioned to me about a week ago, and thinking about this topic today, she told me that she thought after those symptoms developed that I'm not the same man she married. Yeah, that's a horrible way.
And he looked at me and he said, my gosh, you never told me that. You know, but I remember feeling that very much so. I don't think about it now, particularly, you know, after 52 years, but at the time it was frustrating.
Yeah, it's really helpful to hear the, you know, supporter perspective. I know living the experience and feeling so out of control myself and feeling like I was losing my own self, you know, I wasn't the person I had thought I was either. So when finally getting that medical diagnosis and knowing this isn't just me, this wasn't just like my character or something, was like a really big moment. And then finding the new me, right? I guess.
I remember feeling some of the same thing and thinking, if I have a name I can attach to it, it somehow makes it something I can deal with. But then as you read about it, you know, thinking, well, I think we can deal with this sleepiness. I'm not sure we can deal with cataplexy. I hope he doesn't get cataplexy. But then over the next year or so, the cataplexy came, you know, so we had to learn to deal with that. So, you know, narcolepsy has a, because of its chronicness, has stages where you have to cope with things that are different depending upon life and style and where you are and who your family is and all those other outside things that you have to cope with.
But yes. Are you facing sleep issues or a sleep disorder? Project Sleep is now excited to have the Sleep Helpline, a nonprofit-led free national helpline providing personalized support and resources. You can reach out today to speak with a compassionate resource specialist who will listen and help provide accurate sleep disorders information, resources to help navigate daily living and the healthcare landscape, and connect you with a certified sleep center and patient support organizations. Contact the Sleep Helpline at 1-800-819-2043 or by filling out a form on our website at project-sleep.com.
So we've kind of touched on about some hallucination experience with Taylor talking about watching movies, and we've talked about some excessive sleepiness and some emotional meltdowns, but it's interesting to talk about cataplexy. And I feel like it is something we should just touch on if other people have experiences. I'll just share one experience with a past partner that he could both recognize my cataplexy better than I could. He could hear it in my voice before I even realized I had it. He didn't even have to be looking at me, and he could tell. I was trying to read a card. My brother had sent me a funny greeting card, and I was trying to read it out loud to him. And he said, "Sit down, sit down." And I was like, "I just want to read the card. Just let me read the card." He's like, "Why don't you sit down and then read it?" Because he could hear it in my voice. You know, I started to talk like I was having marshmallows. But, and so that was really, I think, you know, wonderful that he was so in tune with the cataplexy. At the same time, he was so in tune with it that he had this one friend that I didn't always love him hanging out with. Of course, I didn't really want to say it out loud because there was nothing hugely wrong with him. I just didn't think he was the greatest influence on my boyfriend. And so when he would say, "Oh, I'm hanging out with him. I'm going to go hang out with him. We're going to go to the bar together," I would start to get cataplexy because I was annoyed. And I didn't want to say I was annoyed. I'd be like, "Oh, that's fine. And then my knees. And then so he'd be like, "What's wrong?" And I said, "That's not fair. That is so not fair." Because besides the fact of the cataplexy, I would have been able, I think, to, you know, it was just an annoyance. It wasn't the biggest problem in the world. But, and so kind of draw that out of me that I didn't love that friend of his. So it's kind of a little bit of an honest, I don't know, made me even more truthful than I wanted to be. So I don't know if anyone else, and of course, I should mention also that before I knew what I had, the cataplexy was also coming up during sexual experiences, which was, you know, frustrating, I guess, but also not the worst place to have cataplexy for me, because at least I was in bed. It wasn't as scary as even walking across the room. So it can, you know, impact different parts of people's like relationships. So I don't know if anyone else has any cataplexy experiences around relationships.
I mean, it does make things a little bit scarier when it's happening for your partner and they're watching. I got a shot when I was at the hospital for something unrelated that was extraordinarily painful. And Steve thought I was having a stroke. And so he was like thinking through like how he was going to call my parents and deal with all of that. And it was just me responding to the pain of the shot. And we're like in a totally different realm because mine is really in my face. And it's just a weird added layer for somebody to figure out when they're watching something happening, but not actually able to deal with it. And, you know, my cataplexy is very mild and it doesn't happen often, but on the hallucination sleep paralysis, that's extraordinarily bad for me. And, you know, Steve will explain that as going from sleeping to standing on the bed, because for those of us that are caught in the sleep paralysis moment, you know, you're having several seconds to minutes of being stuck in this place where you're sort of ratcheting up on the, like, trying to scream or move or whatever is happening. And the other person is just getting the scream when it comes out. So it's a way to be woken up.
Oh my goodness. I did want to talk about naps. I don't know if anyone else has issues around waking up from naps. I often can wake up as, I like to say, I can wake up as either Beauty or the Beast. So I would, if I woke up, sometimes I was very in a negative mood, and in a relationship when we lived together, that was really challenging because I could somehow convince him he was wrong about things, like that he really wasn't even wrong about. It was interesting.
And so we actually came up with like a rule that basically about 30 minutes after I'd wake up from a nap, we wouldn't really interact with each other around the apartment. We just kind of ignore each other. And that actually was a huge, like, much better fix for us to just kind of live around each other for 30 minutes and give myself time to transition. So I was wondering if there's any, you know, anything around that for anybody, like with napping or any other kind of like coping things like that, that you had to kind of figure out.
I know napping is often a coping thing with me, either planned, like Jeff was talking about before, early in the afternoon, or sudden. If I was driving a car, I had 3 or 4 kids in it. They're laughing and listening to the radio and so on, and I felt myself getting sleepy. I'd tell them, I'm going to pull over, and I'm going to take a 15-minute nap. I'll set my alarm. You guys can talk, listen to the radio, do what you want to do. And when I wake up in 15 minutes, we'll be good to go. And that always worked. It was amazing to me how refreshing a 15-minute nap could be. Now I can't even eat dinner without Margaret asking me, did you take a nap? I don't want you falling asleep during dinner. It takes me twice as long to eat as it takes her. At least twice as long.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a coping strategy. You know, you look for those.
I get poked to nap a lot. I usually go to sleep as the beast. And I will continually fight myself to take naps because they always feel good. They always feel better. I'm definitely someone who gets refreshed from the 15-minute nap, and it works every time and still every single day. I'm a 41-year-old woman who's like, you should take a nap. And then there's like the other side of me. It's like, no, you shouldn't take a nap. And then usually while I'm having this conversation with myself, like Steve will poke in and be like, I think you should take a nap.
And do you find that helpful? Because I've heard some people like will be like, no, I don't need a nap if someone else brings it up to them.
Depends on the day. I mean, sometimes I appreciate it. And sometimes I'm like, you're not the boss of me. And then I usually end up taking a nap.
That happens to me. I'm more reluctant to take it when my girlfriend uses the term, do you think you need to go down for a nap? And it's kind of reminds me of when you're putting your kids to bed, you have to put the babies down for a nap. So that term kind of like, no, I don't need that. I don't need to go down for a nap. So it just kind of hits me in the like, just, and it doesn't mean anything by it. It's just the way it sounds. Kind of reminds me of when you're putting your kid down for a nap. I do the same thing as Bob. It's it could be 1 minute, it could be 5 minutes, it could be 20 minutes. I never set the alarm. I just pull over and on the road in the shoulder, and then the air conditioner on, put the seat back, and then when I woke up, I was fine. So I always woke up in a good mood, though. I always wake up in a good mood or in a better mood when I come back from being put down for a nap.
Yeah. I want to add something kind of nerdy onto this one. Just that the unpredictability of our sleepiness, and like you're both talking about, sometimes that need to nap comes on at a really bad time. And when we did a broadcast about napping and narcolepsy, the researcher who we talked to showed a great graph that really explained how our sleep need isn't necessarily higher than other people's, but it's the wakefulness that just drops out at certain times. And I'm saying this because I could take a nap at a time when it's convenient and then still get really sleepy an hour later. And so sometimes the suggestion to take a nap might help me in that moment, but it's not going to guarantee that later in the day I'll be awake for the thing you want me to be awake for. So I think that that's tricky, and it's still nice to point out to someone like, oh, it looks like you're pretty tired, but I maybe don't respond as well to a suggestion that I nap right now.
Yeah, I don't feel like I can schedule. I know I really love and aspire to be a scheduled napper. So I still feel that it comes on a little bit different times, you know, usually sometime in the afternoon. But it is, like you said, Taylor, I think it can be really hard to predict that. And in addition, I think, you know, something that helped my longest relationship and I was talking about the spoon theory. So I don't know if anyone has any analogies like that, because, you know, for me in this relationship, this partner was very interested in doing a lot of things. He was just much more extroverted than I am. So he would want to go to a comedy club like every single night of the week if he could, sort of a person. Or be doing something every night of the week. And that's just not how I'm built, probably in general, but also probably because of narcolepsy. So it wasn't always that I was afraid that I was like, I didn't want to go to the comedy club every night, not because I thought, oh, I'm going to have a need to sleep, or I need to, you know, I might have cataplexy or anything really particular like that. It was just that I had limited spoons, I'd say, or limited energy expenditure to expend over time. So I would just maybe prefer to have like one night a week or two nights a week plans. So the way we would deal with that, it was just say, do you have enough spoons to do this activity? And then I could say, no, I don't have the spoons for it. And that helped because it wasn't always even exactly about a specific symptom, but just more like I got limited, more of a limited bandwidth. So that analogy was really helpful in our relationship to describe something in a different way. Anyone else use any sort of like other code words like that? Or
I mean, we definitely operate off the 80-20 plan, or sometimes the gardener garden.
What's that?
So that sometimes in relationships, you're at 80 and your partner's at 20, or sometimes you're the garden and you need your partner to be the gardener, but recognizing that that needs to flip, and that, you know, you're not always the garden. Sometimes you're the gardener and they need to be the garden, and being able to really communicate about that, because, you know, in this world where sometimes you're 80 and sometimes your partner's 20, is that sometimes you're both going to end up at 20, and that you need to be able to have a conversation about and make a plan for what happens in that moment. And so being super open and honest about that for both of us is really, really strengthened, you know, when we're both in a situation where we need caring for, and what happens next.
What does happen next?
You make a plan. We're going to get takeout tonight, so no one has to cook, or the laundry, you know, can all wait till, you know, 2 days from now when both of us have some energy that we can do it together. Or we're going to drop some plans for this weekend, and all the things that we didn't think we could take care of personally this week, we'll take care of over the weekend. But having a conversation for when there are no spoons, so that it doesn't always feel like one person is taking up the slack, or that the other person feels guilty for being the person who needs their slack taken up. So that you're allowed to throw up the flag that I need help, acknowledging that you're also going to be the person to catch the flag when the other person needs help.
I love that. Anybody else have thoughts?
I think it's easier to know, to have a relationship and accept one another for where you're at, like, you know, the 80-20 you're talking about, when it's just the two of you. What it gets to be difficult sometimes is if you go to a party, or you go to a gathering, like we go to the mall for a coffee group. We're retired, so we have to go and meet other couples that are there. And my stress is that Bob's going to fall asleep sitting there, and he's going to be perceived as not with it, or kind of not, you know, not sharp. And I'm always trying to figure out how to protect him from that, so that people don't see that as something, because, you know, they may know about narcolepsy intellectually, but that's different than living with it. So I think that's a struggle that the partner of the person who has narcolepsy has all of their lives, of knowing how to protect the other person from perceptions that people have.
I think that's so loving. That's such a loving thing to even try to protect. I want someone to protect me from perceptions.
Tell them how you would walk behind me and somebody would walk behind me.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when we had a stage in our lives where his cataplexy was really, really bad before Xyrem, and he was taking tricyclic antidepressants in ever and ever increasing doses to suppress the cataplexy. And what that meant was that he could, you know, collapse at any time. I mean, we would go to the grocery. If he went with me, I would worry that he was going to fall down, or we went someplace. And if if we went to one of the kids' baseball games, I would follow behind him no matter where he went, to know whether or not I had to catch him when he fell down. And one of our best friends, he said to me, "Don't worry about it. I'm behind you. I'm going to catch him if he falls down." So, you know, if there's another couple that are friends with you and can cope and deal with that, that's, but those are the stresses and anxieties of living with someone who has the cataplexy to that extent.
That's so difficult.
It is. We lived on a cul-de-sac and we were out in the yard working. And I think we were having an argument about something and he went around the block to avoid having to talk about it anymore. And at that point, at one point, I heard the fire engines coming. And I thought, oh gosh, I bet he fell down going around the block. And sure enough, I went around the block and there he was collapsed and someone had called the life squad, you know? And so then I went up to him and I had to just touch him in order to have him come out of the cataplexy. And I said, he's okay. He'll be fine. Just let him stand, let him sit there a minute. And the people, you know, the ambulance guys were saying, I thought they were going to make me sign something saying he's okay. I said, no, he's okay. I'm sure he's fine. But, you know, those are the adventures.
Oh my gosh. In the middle of an argument. You know, yeah. Prompted a memory I'd totally forgotten about in Boston. I'd been on, I think, I don't know, I dated a guy for maybe a month. It wasn't very long. But when we ended things, we were in the snow of Boston along the river. And when we broke up, I had cataplexy and I fell into the snow with cataplexy. It was so dramatic. But I was like, I'm fine. I'm fine. At least the snow is soft. So, oh man, so many good and bad memories. Well, let's see. I'm trying to think of any other lessons learned along the way, any other aspects we should talk about. We've talked about sleepiness, some about hallucinations. I don't know if anyone's had any hallucinations. They've gotten confused with reality as far as thinking that your partner might have done something that they didn't.
Oh, I've definitely thought that he said stuff. My hallucinations are almost always auditory, and I've definitely been mad at him for saying things that he didn't that were a hallucination.
How'd you figure that out?
After we had to have an argument about why I was mad at him for something that never happened.
All these examples, thinking about this today, makes me ask the question, is it harder to have narcolepsy or to live with a partner who has, because we don't often think, those of us, I should talk about myself. Having narcolepsy, I don't often think about all the questions and feelings and reactions and wonderings and unknowns that Margaret has to live with and see and wonder what's next and so on. You know, and she wonders, you know, when's the next fall? Am I trying to help him, or making it worse, or both? What might happen in bed tonight? Is he going to be aggressive? Is he going to punch me? And we don't think about what they have to wonder about.
So what do you do then? You buy nice flowers on Valentine's Day, or how do you make this work?
Yeah, we talk about it. You know, I think.
Yeah, the topic comes up and you talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's all you can do. Educational moments. Somebody mentioned that before. I think they're so important, even as a couple. And you mentioned before when we, in the early years of our marriage, but I had cataplexy. We'd go out and be at somebody's house with, you know, three or four other couples. And I'd come over with a tray of hors d'oeuvres and drinks and hover over a sofa to serve it to people. And somebody would say something funny. And I'd collapse right then completely frontward and spill everything on everybody. Educational moment. You can tell them what narcolepsy is, what cataplexy is. Otherwise, they might not know. It doesn't bother me that somebody sees it, as long as somebody's there to explain it, or you can explain it.
I know we're getting over time here. Does anyone have any last thoughts, anything that they were thinking in advance that they wanted to share that they didn't get a chance to yet? I think we've had such a great discussion and covered a lot, but any key takeaways or Anything else they had thought to share?
Thank you so much for putting this together. I think, you know, so often when we talk about narcolepsy, you know, we're talking about the symptoms that we have or what our diagnosis process was like. And, you know, it's really, really navigating these other pieces of it. There is no pill that makes everything better with this disorder, and learning to operate in the world and in your space and with your person, I think is just as difficult sometimes as some of the medical symptoms. So I really, really appreciate having this out in the world.
Likewise. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Anything else, Taylor? Did you have anything else you wanted to?
I'll make this really quick because I think that everything has been really covered by everyone else here, and this has been a wonderful discussion. Bob said something about how fragmented sleep really does impact like every other part of your life. And we all know that the medications can be different. So for me, not being on a nighttime medication to consolidate my sleep, navigating in between wake and sleep states is something that I've had to have conversations with my partners where I might be mostly asleep, but I can still kind of hear a conversation in the room. And he really valued that I honestly told him that early on. I think honesty is so important. And without consolidated restful sleep, it is very hard to make a good decision. This is like neurologically, scientifically true. And I'm not saying that to justify the messiness in my relationships early with narcolepsy, but to say it is so important to prioritize, for me, my sleep and keeping that routine, not just to have energy through the day, but to be that better version of myself. And I think that narcolepsy forced me to confront that maybe sooner than I would have as like a college student, 20-year-old, like actually saying sleeping is going to make my days better. It's going to make my work better. And I think that that is something that like relationships showed me, but it applies to everything. So
that is a beautiful final point. We will have always in all of our toolkits the links to the different resources, and really want to highlight Wake Up Narcolepsy's support groups as well. I was wondering, I don't know, do they have a support group for loved ones or specifically, or is that just sort of the general? Loved ones can attend the general one.
Taylor, I've definitely seen support groups for loved ones that might have actually come from a different group besides Wake Up Narcolepsy, because I don't know that they have a dedicated weekly group for that. You know, but they do have the general groups, or for people in Canada, or for LGBTQ plus people. And those support groups have been so wonderful, such a great resource for me. Sometimes significant others just pop in and say hi or ask a question. Like, they won't sit for the whole meeting. It really depends, but it's great to meet the significant others in those groups too.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, because I think that's an important resource. Sometimes just meeting other people or even other supporters. And so we hope this is just the beginning of a bigger conversation for everybody, and everyone know that they're not alone in dealing with these aspects of narcolepsy. And thank you to our guests today for sharing. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
The Project Sleep Podcast is produced by Carver Sound Productions. For more information on podcast production services, visit carversoundproductions.com.